Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And we will start briefly today with one thing about George H.W. Bush not being discussed very much as the media remembers his life: his roles in the two big Republican scandals during his time in politics. In one, he was quite pure. In the other, much less so. Tomorrow, we'll do a fuller assessment of Bush 41, not just the hagiographies we've been seeing this weekend, but the good, the bad, and the mixed. Like with most very powerful people, it's all there. And we'll try to do that in some fullness and complexity on tomorrow's show. And there is a lot of fullness and complexity there in Bush 41's case. You may not know that he quit the NRA, not after Parkland, but in the 90s, because even back then, the NRA was becoming too radical for him. But also, kudos to Michelle Martin and All Things Considered yesterday for remembering that amid all the accolades for Bush's relative moderation, we should remember he also gave us our most conservative Supreme Court Justice, Clarence Thomas, for the seat previously held by Thurgood Marshall, no less, and Bush remained extremely proud of that his whole life, according to his close aide, C. Boyden Gray, who was the guest on All Things Considered. So more on all that complexity tomorrow. For right now, as we anticipate another eventful week in the Russia investigation, we'll look back for a minute on George H.W. Bush and Watergate and George H.W. Bush and Iran-Contra. Here's a clip of Bush from when he was CIA director under Richard Nixon in June of 1973. Watergate at that time is starting to get hot. And remember how close it is in some basic ways to the Russia scandal. It was a break-in of Democratic Party headquarters to steal some of their files. But they had to do it physically because there was no hacking yet in those days. And that was followed by obstruction of justice by the president to cover it up. Eerily parallel, at least potentially. So it's June of 1973, more than a year before Nixon resigned. And most Republicans are still sticking by Nixon at this time. Bush does too in this clip. But he also firmly denounces the idea of stealing Democratic Party files as bad both morally and politically.
I had a discussion with the president about it before I took this job, and I told him I was concerned about Watergate, and nothing he told me made me feel concerned that he wanted me to go easy on Watergate. He feels the same way I do about it. I'm sure of it. His public statements have said so, and I believe it. And I'm going to continue to believe it until somebody gives some evidence.
But what's wrong with Watergate, Mr. Bush?
I'll tell you what's wrong with it. It's against everything I believe in our system. As head of this party, it's we Republicans. It's me who got out of private life into public life to serve and to believe in the system. And I don't like to see sullied by people breaking the law. I don't like to see it sullied by dirty tricks. And I hurt the worst about it, and so do the Republican leaders across this country. And we want to see it cleaned up. It's bad for our system.
So George H.W. Bush there on Meet the Press in 1973. By August of 74, when things are really coming to light about Nixon's role in the cover-up, Bush is no longer CIA director. He's the chairman of the National Republican Party and becomes one of the top Republicans to actually tell Richard Nixon that he should resign. And you know who wrote about this, told this story? George W. Bush. That's right, George W. Bush, Bush 43, from the book he published about his father in 2014. Here goes. I'm going to read. The final straw came on August 5th, 1974. The Supreme Court had ruled that the White House must turn over all the tapes to Leon Jaworski, the new Watergate special prosecutor and a friend of Dad's from Houston. The tapes revealed that Nixon had spoken to one of his aides about thwarting the FBI's investigation into the Watergate break-in. That was proof that he knew about the cover-up and that he had lied to the country. The revelation shattered Dad's trust in Nixon, August 5th, 1974. Quote, despite his deep disappointment, Still reading from the book, my father refused to condemn Nixon publicly. While he might have benefited in the short run, Dad saw little point in piling on, as he put it. He voiced his opinion privately in a letter to the president on August 7th. As far as I know, he is the only party chairman in American history who has ever written such a letter. I now, and here's a quote from George H.W. Bush's letter to President Nixon on August 7th, 1974. I now firmly feel that resignation is best for this country, best for the president, he wrote. I believe this view is held by most Republican leaders across the country, unquote from the letter. Back to George W. Bush's telling, writing with his characteristic sympathy, Dad continued, this letter is made much more difficult because of the gratitude I will always have for you. If you do leave office, history will properly record your achievements with a lasting respect, unquote. And the next day, as George W. Bush recalls, President Nixon announced that he would resign. So that from W.'s book about his father, with the head of the Republican Party writing to the Republican president, urging him to resign, and the next day he did. So that was Watergate in the 1970s. In the 1980s came President Ronald Reagan's Iran-Contra scandal, secretly selling weapons to Iran in exchange for U.S. hostages, something Reagan had said publicly he would never do because it made it look like the U.S. was paying ransom, and then using money from the Iran arms sale to fund a controversial pro-U.S. rebel group in Nicaragua, the Contras, who Congress had passed a law specifically forbidding military aid to. Now, Bush was Reagan's vice president at the time and then got elected president himself, of course, while a special prosecutor investigation was still going on of Bush and other Reagan appointees. One of those appointees was Reagan's defense secretary, Caspar Weinberger. He was being investigated by special prosecutor Lawrence Walsh. And you know what Bush did with Weinberger when Bush got into office? He pardoned him. Did you know that? This came up just last Sunday on the show ABC This Week when attorney Alan Dershowitz was defending Donald Trump if Trump pardons Paul Manafort.
What Bush did to Caspar Weinberger is identical. He pardoned on the eve of the trial to avoid criminal investigations. The special prosecutor said that. Walsh said that. Nobody suggested criminal prosecution there.
The difference here would be that he's pardoning to protect himself.
So was Bush. He pardoned to protect himself. The great fear was that Caspar Weinberger would point the finger back at him.
Lawrence Walsh, the special prosecutor, the Robert Mueller of his day. Dershowitz with ABC News legal analyst Dan Abrams there. And that brings us to today and our first guest, Politico's Kyle Chaney, who covers Congress usually, but is also reporting a lot right now on the Mueller investigation. Kyle, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Pretty interesting take on Bush from Alan Dershowitz. Bush pardoned former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger because Bush wouldn't be forced to reveal things about himself relating to Iran-Contra.
It's an eerie parallel. It truly is. I think the point, though, from that clip was that there was a policy impetus, I guess, behind the scandal, whereas here it's all about Trump. It's the nature of the scandal, the nature of the controversy, the nature of what the pardon would be about. And actually, Manafort in particular, his campaign chairman, was convicted on crimes completely prior to any of the campaign scandals in question here. So he'd be pardoning him for things like money laundering and tax fraud and stuff that is very, very personal in nature.
That's a very interesting distinction, that the Trump investigation is about things Trump did or may have done with respect to the lengths he was willing to go just to get himself elected. In the case of Reagan and Bush and Caspar Weinberger, you're right. No matter how much of the public may have judged them at the time, no matter what the political opposition may have thought, the Democrats on a policy level, even if this stuff was illegal, they were doing what they believed was in the interest of the country, trading arms for hostages with Iran and then funding the the Contras in Nicaragua, which, you know, Democrats hated that idea. And yet Reagan really thought he was doing it in the interest of warding off communism and protecting the United States.
Exactly. And Bush even made that argument at the time, suggesting, look, if someone should get in trouble for this, it's the president. It's the leadership of the administration, because we were setting the policy, and this was at its heart a policy division. We shouldn't criminalize that. And that's a convenient way to argue something if you might be liable yourself. But it is actually sort of intellectually consistent in a sense with what the nature of the crime was, or the supposed crime was.
And yet they had enough hubris and, one could argue, little enough respect for democracy, which is one of the things mm-hmm. we always say about Trump, that they were willing to thwart what the law was: no arms for hostages, no paying ransom to Iran, no arms deals with Iran at all after they had taken American hostages. And Congress's bill that was passed not to fund the Contras, Reagan mm-hmm. and Bush and Caspar Weinberger and the others basically said, who cares about democracy? We're going to do what we think is right anyway.
Well, it's true, and we actually encounter that in areas in the Trump administration that are independent of sort of the Russia-related things, like the Trump administration's handling of immigration laws and family separations. It's, you know, things like that, where there's questions about are they being true to the letter of the law. Those don't even come up in the conversation of Trump scandals. That's more of just some of the some of the policy controversy that surrounds the administration, but we separate that from the Russia scandal, which is really all about Trump.
And again, listeners, we're planning a rounded view of George H.W. Bush's public life for tomorrow's show, the day before he is laid to rest. But Kyle Chaney from Politico, maybe one of the most stunning developments from this weekend that people may have missed is that Vladimir Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, took the extraordinary step of confirming Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen's version of events, which were, of course, released by Cohen and Mueller last week, about Trump trying to make a Moscow-Trump Tower deal with Putin's government while Trump was running for president. Trump has previously lied to the public, we now know, claiming he had no business dealings with Russia at that time. Here's a clip of Peskov. This may be a little hard to understand, folks, but here it is, and then we'll talk about it.
Emails, two emails, and one telephone call, return telephone call, asking what they wanted and where they were in contact, wanted to be in contact with presidential administration. Also, they were invited to St. Petersburg Economic Forum, because we told them that presidential administration is not dealing with construction works. So we can arrange your contacts with potential Russian counterparts, but there's a perfect opportunity like economic forum.
So you were right offering.
And then they did disappear.
So that's Putin spokesman Dmitry Peskov in Buenos Aires, where Trump and Putin both were this weekend for the G20 summit. I'll read you, if that was unclear, a little bit more of what Peskov said that's to the point. He says there were only these two emails from Cohen, and we called them back in response. We called them back and asked what the presidential administration has to do with that and whether they are aware who they contacted. We told them that the presidential administration doesn't build houses. That's the Putin administration. And if they want to invest in Russia, that we will be happy to see them at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum. And Peskov says, priest, which I am not, should comment on Mr. Cohen's revelations in terms of Cohen's own morality. So, Kyle Chaney from Politico, is Putin trying to undermine Trump by having his spokesman go out and confirm Michael Cohen's story, which confirms that Donald Trump mm-hmm. was lying all these months?
I mean, to be honest, it seems like they know they got caught here, because Peskov had previously denied any response to Cohen when it was first reported that Cohen had reached out in media reports. They said, oh, yeah, we looked and we saw there was an email from him, but no one ever responded to him. And now you see in the plea, they don't just have Cohen saying someone responded, but they have the evidence. They have, you know, correspondence and then records that he got a call and they Cohen spoke to someone there, and now it's suddenly, oh, okay, yeah, that did happen. We did actually correspond. So it seems like it's just an acknowledgement of what may be too late for them to deny at this point.
Because Putin's people and Trump's people were together denying mm-hmm. what has now become clear, right?
Exactly. So it seemed like the Putin administration was essentially helping out Trump by saying, no, there was never a correspondence at all. And now they can't deny what on its face there's proof of.
So there's collusion in at least telling one lie.
If that satisfies the definition of collusion, sure. And Trump has said Cohen is a liar, and you can't take him at face value. And there is some truth to the fact that Cohen has pleaded guilty to multiple lies. But so that's what they're going to fall back on as well. You can't really take his word for it. So we have to see what documentary evidence Mueller really has.
Right. And we should say that these lies about whether there was a real estate deal going on mm-hmm. at the time that Trump was running for president, you know, I guess, as Trump says in a tweet, it was legal to be a real estate guy and do business with Russia. And yeah, I guess, but it presented conflicts of interest that he denied the American people knowledge of when he was a candidate, even when he was asked point blank. And until last mm-hmm. week, you know, while promoting Putin so much during all this time. So it's another example of Trump as a liar. But where might that thread lead with respect to the actual Mueller investigation, since by itself that doesn't have anything to do with the election?
Well, the question is that we get more information here, because remember, we only know publicly what Cohen has pleaded guilty to. We don't know what he's cooperated on and explained in more detail to Mueller that we may find out later. Did this go further? Did the deal making really stop in June of 2016, which is what we now know? It at least went that far. And then when there's all these discussions about lifting sanctions on Russia and Flynn talking to the Russians in the transition, like, was there some nexus between Trump's deal-making ambition and these conversations about sanctions? And then you start to get into the more legally perilous territory.
A related bombshell that you wrote about, and listeners, our phones are open if you want to talk to Kyle Chaney from Politico about the Mueller investigation, what's being revealed now through the Michael Cohen plea with respect to Trump and Putin, all this stuff we've just been discussing, or George H.W. Bush's role in either Watergate or Iran-Contra, as we started with. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. A related bombshell that you wrote about is Cohen's claim now to have coordinated his lies to Congress about Trump and these Russian real estate dealings with the Trump legal team. Can you give us more details about that?
Yeah, so this was a filing. Cohen issued a somewhat lengthy filing over the weekend trying to minimize his sentence and say, here's my level of cooperation. And in this filing, his lawyer said, well, Cohen, when he lied to Congress about the status of this Trump Tower Moscow deal making, he was in constant contact with the Trump White House and the Trump legal team. And he stopped short of saying, I was ordered to lie to Congress by these people. So that's notable, because he did say he was told to lie about things like the Stormy Daniels payment. But it does show that he was a regular, presence with the White House, that he knew who he was. He was getting his messaging talking points from them, and says, I used that to inform what I told Congress. I knew Trump wanted to tell people the deal stopped in January 2016 before the primaries. Well, that's not what he that's what he told Congress. And he says, I took my cues from him.
What was the famous Michael Cohen line from when he was Trump's lawyer?
Says who?
I would die for him. I would take a bullet for him.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. I mean, he modeled himself as the epitome of loyalty. He was the guy who would fight to the death for Trump. He would do anything for him to protect him. And that's why this turnabout, testifying essentially against him, is so remarkable.
And sure enough, he was willing to lie to Congress and put himself mm-hmm. in that jeopardy, as well as lying to investigators and getting himself into all this trouble that he's trying to plea deal himself out of now. He really, really put himself on the hook, committing what he knew were illegal acts, apparently, for Donald Trump, his client.
And he may have assumed that he was going to get he'd get a pardon. If anything ever went awry, he was going to get protected by the president, who now had this authority to do so. I think maybe when he realized that probably wasn't coming, you know, the president's own interests here. And if he pardoned someone, he might be more exposed to obstruction charges. When he realized he wasn't going to get that protection, he said, I better cut my losses here and go with the prosecutors.
So if he was coordinating these lies to Congress about Trump and a real estate deal during the campaign with the Trump legal team, who would be on the hook for conspiracy to lie to Congress, Trump or his lawyers?
Well, that's where we need to know more, because Cohen stopped short of saying I was directed to lie. It may be a little murkier just to say, I think they may say, look, he went and lied on his own. He took it upon himself. He may have thought he was getting an instruction, but he wasn't. And so you need more than that just to say there's a conspiracy to lie. But the question is, are there other lies? Are there other examples of things he said to Congress or other investigators where he was directed to say something other than what was true?
We also learned last week that Trump's lawyers and Manafort's lawyers were sharing information, even while Manafort was a cooperating witness with Mueller. Is any of that illegal or presidential obstruction?
This gets right to the line on sort of what's ethical in the legal community. Lawyers essentially coordinating to undermine a plea agreement. I don't know enough to know whether that breaks any laws. There's been a lot of smarter people than me in terms of what happens in the legal community about whether someone could be disbarred for that, and whether someone could be forced to testify if, in fact, Manafort committed additional crimes with the aid of his lawyers in this process.
And in a way, that brings us back to Bush 41 pardoning Caspar Weinberger. According to Alan Dershowitz, apparently that time it worked to keep the Iran-Contra special prosecutor off President Bush's tail and protect his friend Weinberger at the same time. This time there are other prosecutors who could still go after Manafort who aren't in the federal system, right?
Correct. He is exposed at the state level for many crimes as well, and that would most likely prevent him from getting off the hook with a presidential pardon. Could be a factor in Trump's calculus. I'm not going to keep him out of jail, so I don't have that much leverage here. But it's something that would blunt the effectiveness of clemency if Trump would use that as a tool to protect himself, too.
And that would be right here in New York State. Some of those alleged crimes having to do with real estate and bank fraud that Manafort was already convicted of. So if he gets pardoned for all that stuff, the New York State Attorney General or even maybe the Manhattan District Attorney could go back after him if they so choose and get testimony related to Trump if it's relevant.
Right. We may get a fight about double jeopardy issues as questions about whether, since he was already convicted of a certain fact pattern, could you retry him at the state level? Even if it's based essentially the same elements of a crime are on trial. So that's going to be a legal fight with maybe larger implications that could be coming up.
Josh in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Josh, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Just a quick point. Bush actually pardoned on Christmas. At the end of his term, he pardoned six people additionally having to do with Iran-Contra. And there was talk at the time that part of Iran-Contra was to get Reagan elected because the Iranians held the hostages until he was elected.
I think it was a different set of hostages. Kyle, are you clear on this? I know there were the 1979 hostages,
right,
who were held throughout that presidential campaign, and Carter was seen
as 400 days and or whatever.
And released on Reagan's inauguration day. So there might have been some kind of dealing behind the scenes with Iran, but I'm not clear on this history. I think the other thing might have been later.
But to Josh's point, Bush was on his way out when he issued these sort of last minute pardons. Trump still theoretically is running for re-election, is going to face a hostile Democratic Congress coming up. So his actions at this stage in the game, even if he decided to issue a Christmas time pardon for Manafort, he's a lot more exposed to what Congress might do in response.
Sherry in Long Island City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sherry.
Hey, good morning. I'm just calling to drawing a little more attention to Rachel Maddow's podcast, Bagman. And the,
yes, about
the part.
About Spiro Agnew, Nixon's yeah. vice president, who people who don't know history may not know, had to resign first.
Yeah, exactly. But George Bush, George H.W. Bush, was very involved in helping to pressure George Beall, the federal attorney in Maryland, to try to get him to stop his investigation, because Beall's brother was a Republican U.S. senator at the time. And in H.R. Haldeman's audio diary, he talks about how he doesn't want to do it, but they eventually talk to H.W. Bush and get him to do it. And this is when he was head of the RNC.
Interesting. I did not know that history, so very interesting there, if that's being accurately related. Here's a question via Twitter. Kyle, let me get this back up. Has a presidential pardon ever been found to be obstruction of justice? Do you know the answer to that?
I believe not. I think we've only had a couple impeachment proceedings, and that would really be the forum for where you determine that. And none were for pardon related matters. But I guess we're dealing with a lot of novel areas of law and constitutional questions that could be tested here. A lot of people who think pardon power is absolute. Alan Dershowitz would tell you if the president uses his lawful pardon authority to pardon someone, you can't challenge that. It's just absolute. A lot of people would say, but if you use that pardon authority in a way that was intended specifically to undermine an investigation into you, that does not protect you from obstruction charges and certainly not from Congress's ability to impeach.
Right, even though Dershowitz seems to be arguing that even under those circumstances, it does. There's this reference in the Mueller court filing about Michael Cohen to Trump, but Trump is called individual number one. Can you explain the individual number one thing?
Sure. A lot of times in these filings, they don't name anyone who isn't specifically indicted or listed as a co-conspirator necessarily as a matter of law. You see this a lot in filings where the person is obvious. It's very you can deduce who the candidate running for president with the Donald J. Trump for president campaign is. if it's listed that way. But Trump has come up as individual one, as client one in Cohen's sentencing document. He's been candidate one, and I think the Stormy Daniels. So there's a lot of euphemisms for Trump in these legal filings, but they're building up.
And this, of course, has become the source of instant mockery, instant, comedy, Trump being referred to as individual number one. Later in the show, listeners, Peter Sagal, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, will be on. He has a new book. We'll also play a clip from this weekend's Wait, Wait, where the term individual number one comes up in a very unexpected way. So that's coming up with Peter Sagal later. And there was another reference, Kyle, to Trump in a Mueller court filing last week. We haven't gotten to this on the show, but it's actually very interesting, I think, with respect to Jerome Corsi, mm-hmm. a Roger Stone associate who claimed to have advanced knowledge of WikiLeaks having Democratic emails and even when they would be released. Now Corsi denies it as Mueller is on his tail. But what was the Trump reference there? Do you know?
I remember the reference. I'm trying to remember what the context was, but I do know that there were reports that Trump's lawyers were incensed that he was named without one of those euphemisms, without an individual one kind of reference in there, because it is rare to do that in a prosecution document to name someone who isn't a subject or target of that particular filing. And so I can't recall off the top of my head why they mentioned him there. I think maybe it was that there were communications, like Roger Stone, a Corsi associate, was in touch with Donald Trump.
I think that's
during the.
Yeah,
I think that's what it was.
I think that's exactly what it was. The Corsi was in regular contact with Roger Stone, and Roger Stone was in regular contact with Trump.
With Donald Trump.
At this time, that Corsi was telling Cohen that he knew that WikiLeaks had the Democratic emails and knew when they were going to come out.
Right. So they established this chain of contacts that could potentially tell you that WikiLeaks had gotten advance notice indirectly to Trump of what they had. And while it's not really established explicitly here, I think that's why the Trump lawyers were so upset, was it's definitely some insinuation that that may have been a path toward collusion.
Right. And may have are the operative words, because we don't want to get beyond the facts in any of these stories. And that's what Mueller would have to discover in order to get Trump himself on any of that. Of course, there are other people very close to Trump in that loop, like his son and his son-in-law, and who were at that famous June Trump Tower meeting.
Right.
So we'll see. By the way, I see that Corsi, I guess as of this morning, has filed some kind of ethics complaint about Mueller. Do you know what Corsi is claiming, or if that could impede the investigation?
Essentially, I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen the complaint language itself, but he's said publicly that he thinks that Mueller's team instructed him to lie about his own business dealings, that he's required to report to securities officials if he's in legal jeopardy. But because his proposed plea deal was under seal, they told him not to tell anyone. And so he's claiming he was instructed to lie, essentially.
Yeah, or pressured to lie.
Right. And so he uses publicly very hostile language about Mueller's team. He compares them to the North Koreans a lot and says they're really running wild with him. And so he's using that as the basis for this complaint that probably doesn't have legs.
That was filed on behalf of Corsi by a conservative legal activist group, Freedom Watch. Does it have the potential to impede anything about Mueller's investigation, or do you think probably not?
Not really, except the only wild card here is, and he keeps referencing this, he says, I'm filing it with Matt Whitaker, who's the new acting attorney general, and he's someone who has been very hostile to the Mueller investigation and is someone whose appointment was really unnerved a lot of people who are Mueller supporters, because they think he could use his power as acting attorney general to interfere with Mueller. And so if he's motivated to, he could act on a complaint like Corsi's. But we haven't seen any evidence that he's actually intending to do that.
And before you go, you wrote about another Republican effort to distract attention from the actual content of the investigation before they lose control of the House at the end of the year. They've subpoenaed James Comey to testify again this Friday. What's the point of that?
So Republicans have run this almost 2-year-long investigation to try to show what they say is anti-Trump bias in the FBI and the pro-Hillary Clinton bias, and that undergirded the Clinton and Trump the Russia investigations that went on in 2016. Comey has been out of the public eye for a while since his book came out, and now they're trying to bring him back into it to sort of revive that discussion of his handling of those probes, just as the Republicans are about to lose power in the House.
Will this be public testimony or private testimony?
It's private. That's what the subpoena was about. Comey said, I want to testify publicly. Don't make me go behind closed doors. I don't trust that you're going to tell the truth about what I say. And they said, no, we're Congress. We can tell you when and how to come. And so they fought this out in court, and Comey eventually withdrew his legal challenge and has agreed to come publicly if they release a transcript within 24 hours.
What makes them think Comey testifying again will be good for Trump and bad for Mueller?
I don't think there's any real reason for them to think that. You know, Comey's testimony last time, publicly was not particularly helpful to the president. I think he's been dragged through the ringer a bit by Trump and Republicans since then. And I think anything they get from him that sort of furthers this idea that the FBI was out to get Trump is something that they will blare no matter what else he tells them.
Last thing, what else are you anticipating this week?
That's a dangerous question. We're always on indictment watch. The Stone and Corsi stuff seems to be coming to a conclusion sometime soon. But as with everything with Mueller, you never know. It could be days, weeks, minutes, months before we hear anything.
Kyle Chaney covers Congress for Politico. These days, he's also very much on the Mueller investigation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.